The sanctuary is full. The lights are warm. Applause rolls before the sermon ends. A young man steps forward in a sharp suit, Bible in one hand, confidence in the other. He talks about stewardship. He talks about blessing. He says God rewards discipline and faith with return. Heads nod. Pens come out. Trust settles in the room. After service, doors close. Small groups form. Retirement accounts are discussed in hushed tones. Life savings are framed as seeds. The word safe comes up again and again. People sign checks they never planned to write. They believe they are protecting their future without betraying their faith. Months later, the phone calls start. Payments are late, then missed. Excuses replace statements. Churches hesitate. Pastors stall. Congregants wait. Some still pray it will work out. Others realize the money is gone. And the question tightens like a vice. How did a promise spoken from the pulpit turn into silence when the savings ran out? Chapter 1. The pitch from the pulpit. On a Sunday morning, the sanctuary fills early. Ushers move people down the aisles, guiding them into rows that stretch wall to wall. The music swells, hands rise, the sermon builds toward hope, discipline, and reward. The message is familiar. Faith brings order. Order brings blessing. Near the end of service, the pastor pauses. He smiles and gestures toward a man waiting near the front row. The introduction is polished. A young millionaire. A believer. Someone who figured it out early and wants to give back. The congregation applauds before the man says a word. The speaker steps forward. He wears a tailored suit. His voice is calm and confident. He opens with scripture about stewardship. He talks about responsibility, about using what God gives wisely. He tells the room he once sat where they sit now, broke, searching, wanting more for his family. Then he shifts. He talks about opportunity, Christian investment, safe growth, returns that honor God. He avoids technical language, no charts, no fine print. He frames money as a tool for ministry and security. He says the investments are conservative, protected, built for people who want peace of mind. The word safe lands softly but firmly. He does not mention licenses. He does not mention filings. He does not mention risk. What he offers instead is reassurance. He says his investors are church-going people just like them. He says pastors trust him. He says God led him to this work. The room listens. After the benediction, no one rushes for the exits. Ushers direct interested members to side rooms and fellowship halls. Clipboards appear. Names are written down. Phone numbers collected. People who never plan to talk about money at church sit back down. In small groups, the tone shifts from inspirational to personal. Retirement comes up. College funds. Fixed incomes. The speaker or his associates lean in and listen. They nod at the right moments. They tell stories about other believers who took the same step and now sleep better at night. Checks are discussed without urgency, but with certainty. The message is clear. This is not a gamble. This is stewardship. Several attendees later recall how natural it felt. They trusted the church. They trusted the pastor who stood beside the man. They trusted the language of faith that wrapped around the pitch. They did not feel sold to. They felt invited. One retiree describes pulling funds from a long-held account she had guarded for decades. She remembers thinking she was finally doing something active with her money instead of letting it sit. Another investor recalls cashing out part of a pension, encouraged by the promise that it would grow faster without risk. None of them recall seeing official documents. The tour does not stop at one church. It moves city to city, sanctuary to sanctuary. The pattern repeats: warm introductions, familiar scriptures, testimonials from early participants who say their statements look good. Pastors vouch from the pulpit. Congregants sign up in numbers that surprise even seasoned church administrators. Behind the scenes, the operation runs lean. Meetings are informal, paperwork is light, questions about registration are brushed aside with confidence. The explanation is always the same. This is private, this is faith-based, this is not Wall Street. In several churches, volunteers help organize the sessions. They set up chairs, they make coffee, they feel proud to support something that promises uplift instead of need. They see no reason to doubt a man welcomed so openly by leadership. As weeks pass, money flows in, checks arrive by mail, wire transfers follow. Investors receive confirmations that sound official enough. Some see initial payments that reinforce trust. the reassurance deepens. No one publicly asks where the money is actually going. Those who hesitate feel subtle pressure. Friends mention how confident they feel. Church leaders mention how many members have already joined. The decision is framed as a step of faith, not a financial calculation. A few people do ask questions. They want to know how returns are generated. They ask about oversight. The answers are smooth but vague. Real estate, private lending, opportunities not available to the general public. The details stay just out of reach. At the pulpit, the speaker is careful. He never demands, he suggests. He reminds the room that God loves a wise steward. He lets the implication do the work. Across the circuit, no standardized disclosures are provided during services or follow-up meetings. There are no clear risk statements delivered from the stage. No explanation of what happens if investments fail. The environment does not invite skepticism. The churches involved are not obscure. Many are large, influential, and deeply trusted in their communities. Their endorsement carries weight beyond the sanctuary walls. Congregants bring in relatives. Friends call friends. The network expands quietly and quickly. By the time anyone notices inconsistencies, the sums involved are already significant. At this stage, there is no crash, no alarms, no police tape, just momentum, money moving on faith and familiarity, trust standing in for verification. The pitch has done its job, and the question lingers beneath the hymns and handshakes, unspoken, but growing heavier with every signed check. How did no one stop to ask what protections were actually in place before so much was handed over? Chapter 2. Inside the wealth machine. The tour does not slow down. It tightens its rhythm. One church leads to another. One introduction opens the door to five more. Schedules fill months ahead. Flights are booked. Assistants handle logistics while the message stays consistent. Inside each church, the pitch becomes familiar. The same phrases, the same assurances, the same promise that faith and discipline can protect families from uncertainty. What changes is the scale. Money arrives faster now. Larger checks, rolled over retirement accounts, funds pulled from savings that were never meant to move. Investors talk among themselves. They compare notes. Early returns are mentioned, sometimes exaggerated, sometimes misunderstood. The effect is the same. Confidence spreads. Behind the sermons, the operation looks different. The companies tied to the investments are layered and loosely defined. Names shift, descriptions blur. Some entities claim to invest in real estate, others in private lending. The paperwork given to investors lacks detail about how funds are allocated or safeguarded. There is no independent oversight presented to congregants, no clear explanation of custodians or third-party controls. For many investors, the only assurance is the voice they heard from the pulpit and the pastor who stood beside it. The structure relies on proximity and trust. This is affinity marketing in its purest form. The pitch works because it comes from someone who looks like the audience, speaks their language, and shares their faith. Doubt feels like betrayal. Questioning feels like a lack of belief. Pastors play different roles. Some actively encourage participation. Others remain hands-off, but allow the sessions to happen on church property, which signals approval without words. In both cases, the presence of the church legitimizes the pitch. As the months pass, small cracks appear. A scheduled payment arrives late. An explanation follows quickly. Administrative delay, banking issue, market timing. The tone remains confident. Investors are told not to worry. Another payment misses its date, then another. Phone calls increase. Emails go unanswered longer than before. When responses come, they are polite but vague. The language shifts from certainty to patience, from assurance to prayer. Some investors approach church leadership quietly. They ask for help getting answers. The response varies. In some cases, pastors reassure them that everything is being handled. In others, leaders say the investments were private matters and outside church responsibility. The discomfort grows. A few congregants push harder. They want documentation. They want timelines. They want to know how money can be both safe and delayed. Their questions circulate among leadership, but rarely from the pulpit. Behind closed doors, church administrators worry about liability. They worry about reputation. They worry about panic. Silence becomes the easiest option. Meanwhile, the tour continues. New churches hear nothing about delays elsewhere. Each stop exists in its own bubble of optimism. Each group believes it is early, protected, chosen. The machine depends on that separation. Regulators eventually notice patterns that do not align with lawful investment activity. Complaints surface. Some are formal. Others are whispers that reach the right desks. Unregistered securities. Promised returns without disclosure. Funds pooled without transparency. Inquiries begin quietly. Requests for information. Notices sent. The process moves slower than the money did. Inside the operation, explanations grow thinner. Investors are told restructuring is underway, that assets are being repositioned, that patience will be rewarded. The language remains confident, but the substance fades. Some congregants begin to realize the truth before it is spoken aloud. Their savings are tied up, their calls are ignored, their churches are hesitant to intervene. The man who once spoke so clearly now feels distant. The emotional toll becomes visible. Retirees return to work part-time. Couples argue over decisions made in faith. Adult children confront parents who believe the church would never allow harm. Shame keeps many quiet. They do not want to admit they were misled by someone they trusted. Within churches, tension rises. Leaders hear rumors from other congregations. They begin to compare notes. The picture grows darker. Still, few speak publicly. The fear of causing harm outweighs the fear of staying silent. By the time regulatory scrutiny sharpens, the damage is already widespread. The wealth machine does not collapse in a single moment. It slows, it strains, it sheds excuses. What once felt like momentum now feels like delay stretched thin. Authorities prepare their next steps. The tour that once promised safety now carries a different weight. Not spoken from the pulpit, but felt in every unanswered call and every missed payment. The system that protected the pitch has failed the people, and the money is no longer moving forward. It is disappearing. Chapter 3, The Cost of Belief. The end does not arrive with a single announcement. It comes in pieces. A notice here, a filing there, words that finally replace silence. Federal authorities step in after months of complaints, delays, and unanswered questions. What had been framed as faith-based opportunity is now examined as financial activity subject to law. Investigators trace money flows. They review promises made from pulpits and in private meetings. They separate belief from paperwork. The findings are no longer matters of opinion. Court records establish that the investments were not registered, that funds were misrepresented, that promised uses of money did not match how it was actually handled. These are not allegations from frustrated investors. They are determinations reached through investigation and admitted in court proceedings. For victims, the confirmation lands with mixed weight. Some feel relief that the truth is finally spoken aloud. Others feel hollow. Being right does not return what is gone. In court, the scale becomes clear. Retirement accounts drained, life savings redirected, funds intended for security rerouted into a structure that could not deliver what was promised. The language of stewardship collapses under documentation. Victims speak about what the loss meant. One describes postponing retirement indefinitely. Another talks about selling a home earlier than planned. Some admit they no longer trust their own judgment. Others say the damage to their faith hurt more than the money. The court separates what can be recovered from what cannot. Restitution is ordered within limits. It does not come close to replacing everything lost. The numbers matter on paper, but the impact stretches beyond accounting. Sentencing closes the legal chapter, but not the human one. Churches respond unevenly. Some issue statements expressing regret and distance. Others remain quiet. A few acknowledge their role in allowing the pitch to take place, but stop short of accepting responsibility. The legal boundaries are clear. The moral ones are not. Congregants look at familiar sanctuaries differently now. Spaces that once felt safe carry echoes of what happened. Trust once assumed now requires proof. Regulators issue warnings about affinity fraud. They describe how shared identity and faith can be weaponized. They urge skepticism even in trusted spaces. The advice arrives late for many, but it aims to prevent repetition. Within Black faith communities, conversations grow sharper. Some leaders call for stronger financial literacy. Others demand accountability when churches allow financial activity on sacred ground. The debate is tense. No one wants to admit vulnerability, but ignoring it has proven costly. For victims, healing is uneven. Some find support groups. Others stay silent, carrying shame they never earned. The fraud took money, but it also took confidence. It changed how people listen, how they give, how they believe. The story becomes a cautionary one, passed quietly between congregations. A reminder that trust is not a substitute for verification, that faith does not cancel risk, that familiarity can be dangerous when it replaces scrutiny. In the end, the court delivers judgment. The system closes the case. But the cost of belief remains scattered across households, retirement plans, and relationships that will never fully reset. The pulpit is quiet again. The checks have stopped, and the lesson sits heavy in the aftermath. Faith can inspire generosity, but when protection is promised without proof, the damage lasts far longer than the sermon.